This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Kings of Sport, the podcast that's changing the game one show at a time, with your hosts, Alfred Cottaway, Nate Milton, and Marcus Vanderberg. So sit back and relax, because you're now down with the Kings. And welcome to the Kings of Sport, the podcast that's changing the game one show at a time, a.k.a. the world's most dangerous sports show, a.k.a. iTunes' longest-running weekly episodic sports program hosted by two or more African-Americans who are not affiliated with a major network. I am the Godfather, Nate Milton, joined, as always, or as usual, by Big Nasty Alfred Cunnell and Marcus Vanderberg.
Welcome back. How are you guys doing? This is good.
I'm good. I mean, for those that was wondering where I was on the 50th episode, I won't get into details, but all I will say is Belbert DeVoe was accurate in their wisdom years ago when they said, "Never trust a big butt and a smile." That's all I'm going to say about that. But I
How about that, Marcus? We did the 50th episode. There was no fanfare or ceremony. That's terrible. We didn't have any parties. I mean, it was just a takeover, but the 50th episode seems kind of inconsequential.
I mean, is it important?
Yes.
I mean, we got the year anniversary coming up next week, so I figured we can't have two big events because then what, you know, show 51 would be such a letdown.
That's true because like WWE did Raw 1000 and then they didn't celebrate the 20th anniversary of Raw, so you got to kind of pick and choose these things, right?
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd much rather focus on our year anniversary coming up in a week, and you know, it's going to be a good time. I heard the show last week with the West Coast connection, and you know, you guys did a good job, and you know, I won't worry next time I'm out or I get sick. So you know, I know you guys can handle the ship.
Yeah, Mark, it was a lot of fun.
He didn't trust us.
Yeah, seriously, what the hell, Nate?
Hey, sometimes you know you gotta step back like Seth Rollins, and you gotta see what the other two men of the team can do.
Okay, so were you stepping back or were you walking out on the team? Because there's a difference.
Who's the glue of this team then?
I don't know. It's a lot of glue. It's a lot of glue and it's a lot of crazy. So it's all in there. But it is good to be back. We got a lot of great things to talk about this week. I think the first thing we're going to talk about, fellas, to kick off the A block is we're going to talk about heroes. And heroes and mentors are very important in one's personal development. And, you know, heroes can be a parent, a teacher, a religious leader, a sports figure, or even a future version of yourself. Shout out to Matthew McConaughey.
I was watching the Oscars with a bunch of people. We popped when he said, all right. That's what we were watching the Oscars for, that moment.
Only McConaughey could get away with saying, you know, somebody said, who do you look up to? Who's your hero? And I said, it's me in 10 years. And then 10 years later, I said, it's me 10 years from now. And it's going to keep being me 10 years down the road. Like only he could get away with saying some stuff like that. Oh, but there is a young man in Indianapolis who Marcus may have crossed paths with a couple weeks ago that may need to reevaluate who he chooses as his hero, as his mentor, and that is one Paul George. And fellas, we got to get into this because I have a lot of thoughts, and I'm sure you guys have a lot of thoughts too on Paul George and his recent solicitation of a mentor, if you will.
Yeah, I mean he's put it out there this week that he wants LeBron James to, you know, help mentor him. He wants to go to the best player in the league, and normally this would be okay, but when you are two rivals in the same conference and you've spent all offseason making your number one objective is to go after the Miami Heat, then yeah, it's a little awkward that midway through the season, right before the playoffs, you're putting it out there that you want to go to LeBron for help.
Yeah, I hate it. And this just made me think of Kobe Bryant at the All-Star game when he said that, you know, trash talking is a lost art. But he was speaking to a bigger issue that this day and age that we live in the NBA is a day and age where everybody's friends and everybody loves each other and everybody's planning to be on a super team. And it's like BFFs and sleepovers. I hate it because I remember in the Jordan days, nobody would admit that Jordan was the best player in the game. Not Charles Barkley, not Hakeem Olajuwon, not Penny Hardaway, nobody. Everybody thought that they can be the one to beat Jordan, and there was just a moxie to the NBA to where everybody wanted to compete with Jordan. But this day and age, it's like everybody falls into a pecking order, and now they're trying to position themselves to try to play with each other. And I just feel like this is a precursor to one day Paul George and LeBron James maybe ending up on the same team. So I couldn't stand hearing Paul George kiss up to his rival.
Yeah, I did not like it at all. I mean, it's one thing for LeBron and Kevin Durant to work together in the offseason. But it's another thing altogether to ask your chief rival, who you are still competing with, as Marcus mentioned, to be your mentor, be your big brother. And it's like, come on. First of all, if you want to ask somebody who was kind of a contemporary, ask Kobe. Go call Kobe because Kobe ain't doing nothing right now. If you want to talk to somebody, he doesn't even have to leave the Pacer family. There's Reggie Miller, Larry Bird. There's a lot of leadership in there. There's a lot of guys that could be quality mentors for Paul George, but with LeBron, I think it's a case of, LeBron, because LeBron came out and he was real slick with it. He was like, I have no problem talking to all of these young fellas. And he kind of took Paul George out of that category of being a competitor to, being a nephew, to being a son, if you will, and delineating the gap in talent between himself and Paul George. And I think LeBron, I don't think we give him credit enough for being a veteran of the game and a student of the game and somebody that knows how to play that mental aspect. And I think if Paul George is not careful, he can get caught up with some Jedi mind tricks, Marcus.
Well, I think the reason why he has LeBron on his mind is because of the type of body and type of style of play that both guys play. I mean, Kobe is just a shooting guard. I think if you look at Paul George, he's 6'9". He's probably, he's bigger than LeBron in terms of height-wise. He's not there in terms of body size. But I can understand why he wants to sort of model his game after LeBron, because that's what, Paul George is only 22, I believe, 23. So I think he wants to develop and eventually grow into that same beastly small forward mode. And LeBron's the perfect guy to build from. But yeah, he's running the risk of really putting himself in a weird spot because, I understand with between the Olympics and the offseason, these guys hanging out and whatnot, but it's just the timing more than anything that I have the problem with the story.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Is that they're in the thick of, we're going to be in the playoffs a month from now, and the Pacers are really the only team in the Eastern Conference, maybe even in the NBA, that could stop the Heat. It's a two-horse race in the Eastern Conference, and then you hear Paul George a month out from the playoffs saying that he wants to be mentored by LeBron James. It's like, I hate to be cliche, but it's like if you heard Muhammad Ali say he wants to be mentored by Frazier. I mean, it completely takes away from the rivalry.
And the other thing is, it's one thing to, like I said, to work out with the guy and study his work ethic and his training regime and his fitness regimen and things like that. But to come out in public, that's, he didn't even go through some back NBA secret secure channels. He came out and was like, I would love to be mentored by LeBron James. I think I can learn a lot from that guy. You put yourself in a subservient position, and I think that, he is a young guy. I think, 22, 23 years old. He probably has looked up to LeBron for a long time. But by the same token, you have to view yourself as somebody who is on the same level as that guy. You can't be in awe of that guy because, if you're viewing LeBron James as an icon or somebody that on that stature, then, you lost the mental battle as soon as you step on the court.
Yeah, and it's one thing. I'm sure everybody wants to be mentored or at least learn something from LeBron James. He is literally the best player in the world. I'm sure everybody would love to get a piece of that knowledge. But to say that, it's one thing. It's another thing. You have to almost be delusional if you want to be great. You have to have a delusional sense of self that you're better than everything, even LeBron James. Paul George, if he wants to be great and he wants the Pacers to be great, has to believe that he is better than LeBron James, even if it's not true. He just legitimately has to be delusional about that fact. And the fact that he's not only coming out in public and saying that, but he actually seems to believe this, I would be scared if I was a Pacers fan.
I mean, scared of what, though?
I'll be scared of – you want to talk about the mental battle. If okay, are the Pacers really that interested, at least Paul George, is he really that interested in being great if he has obviously already succumbed to him? Or maybe it's – if unless it's one of these instances like when Pedro Martinez said the Yankees are my daddy and he was just playing mind games. I mean, I wouldn't think it's that he's that cerebral. I think he legit means this, and I don't like the fact that Paul George has already succumbed to LeBron James mentally.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit of a stretch. I mean, come on. You can say all you want about, oh, you expect the guy to believe he's the best. Let's be real. He's not the best player in the NBA. And it'd be foolish for him. It'd be foolish for him to think he was the best player in the NBA.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying, is that you have to be delusional.
I tend to agree with you, Marcus. I think the bigger issue for the Pacers is I think that they've started to stumble down the stretch. And I think Evan Turner really hasn't found his role on the squad. I think that there's some things that they need to tighten up, and Frank Vogel's got to get those boys back on track. Do you still see them as the front runner in the East, or do you think that Miami's kind of regained that torch?
No, I mean, I think the champs have always been the front runner, despite the record that, you know, they're two-time champs for a reason. And even though Miami is currently second in Eastern Conference, I don't think that's going to matter when it comes to the playoffs. I will say that it will help for them to have the first seed and have Eastern Conference, or have home advantage in the Eastern Conference, because I think if it goes 7 games, you don't want to have a game 7 in Indiana and take that risk. So, yeah, I think they need to still make up ground, but I got to see the Pacers play on Tuesday against Golden State in Indiana. And they still have some issues that they're working on. Evan Turner was a bit of a dud that night. I think they're still trying to figure out what to do with this roster, and we still haven't seen Andrew Bynum yet, if he's actually going to play for them or if he's just on the roster to keep him out of Miami's hands.
Yeah, that's a good point. Real quick, kind of swinging over to the West, we saw the Spurs beat down the Heat, sleeves or no sleeves. I think it was a telling performance as the Heat and the Spurs split the season series. We saw the Clippers acquire Danny Granger, and I think that just adds depth to that roster. We see Houston, who is still holding things down in the West. In terms of that side of the docket, in terms of that conference, how do you kind of grade out those horses and those contenders, Marcus?
I think that despite the record, the Clippers might be playing the best basketball currently in the West, and the additions of Granger and Glenn Davis to that team. If they ever do get J.J. Redick back for the playoffs, I think they would have, you know, the scariest team. And they actually have a coach this year compared to Vinny Del Negro. The last couple of seasons where they've made the playoffs and San Antonio's come in and just dominated them. So on paper, I would put the Clippers 1. And then I would still go San Antonio 2 just based on the experience they have. I'm not really buying Houston yet as a legit threat. And with Oklahoma City, I'm just curious to see what they do with Russell going forward in terms of how he's going to impact their team. I know they've struggled a little bit since he came back to the lineup. So I would put the Clippers 1 and San Antonio 2.
Yeah, and if I was thinking the same thing myself, and I think if it comes down to those two teams, you know, as talented as the Clippers are, I wouldn't put it past the Spurs. I mean, I think they're getting healthy at the right time, and you know, Pop always has something up his sleeve, and that's just a veteran squad. And I think if anybody is going to outwork the Clippers, I think it could be that San Antonio squad.
Yeah, what scares me about the Spurs is they're just not, they haven't been very good against top elite teams. And that in the NBA, in college, I don't mind it. But in the NBA, it always speaks volumes if teams cannot beat elite teams. So, and the Spurs have always been so close with no cigar. They're like the Patriots, to where it's that time where they're going to be competitive, they're going to be in the thick of things, but they just can't seem to complete the job, and they're only getting older. And the Clippers, I cannot stress enough how I think the Clippers are going to be dangerous and get hot at the right time, because what was most important in the Clippers this season is the maturation of Blake Griffin, who got so much better in Chris Paul's absence and was able to mature and take on a bigger role. I think that's only going to make the entire team better, let alone the addition of Danny Granger. And the Rockets, I think, are going to be that team that, yeah, they've had the best overall record since January 1st, I believe, but I just don't see them as a playoff-ready team when the game slows down.
Speaking of the Rockets, they're currently up by 30 against Indiana, so...
So I guess that mentorship program isn't working out too well.
Maybe Dwight should be his mentor. He's 7 right now.
Oh, Paul George, man. It's hard times. It's hard, but that's what I was talking about. You know, I think all these little side issues are kind of obfuscating the point that, you know, the Pacers really haven't been the Pacers since the All-Star break. At least not the Pacers that we saw at the beginning of the season.
No, but I mean, the Thunder haven't been the Thunder since the All-Star break, and I don't think people are too worried about them. So, and the fact that they're still two games up in Miami says a lot about, yeah, they've struggled, but I mean, they still have they're still the best team in the NBA, I think, record-wise still. So,
yeah. I don't think you can grade the Miami's regular season is such an aberration in that they're just trying to get healthy and they're playing and they want to win games, but winning is not a priority to Miami in the regular season.
Well, it should be.
They're just trying to get there. It should be, but they are so good and they've got the best player in the world, and they've got, if they have a moderately healthy Dwayne Wade, it makes them the best team in the NBA bar none. And they've got Greg Oden, who they're saving for the playoffs. They are building this team strictly for a playoff run. So to look at the Miami Heat and look at what they're doing in the playoffs, the fact that the Pacers are only two games up on Miami just kind of tells me that Miami's like way better than they should have been in the regular season.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, like I mentioned earlier, like you don't want to run the risk of having to take a Game 7 on the road, and not only Eastern Conference, but currently the Western Conference. If somehow Miami made it to the finals and faced Oklahoma City or San Antonio, that Game 7 that they had last year in their pocket in Miami would be on the road in either Oklahoma City or San Antonio. So I do think eventually they'll turn it on for these final 20 games.
Yeah, so you're saying LeBron has something up his sleeve?
Yeah, I mean, they've
I see what you did there.
Oh. Well, they've lost two in a row, but besides that, they were on a bit of
it's a sleaze, man.
Bit of a run there. Hey, yeah, and he brings up a good point, though. He's 0-14 with those stupid sleeves on. From a three-point.
Yeah, well, I don't think it was so much an excuse as an explanation, but it still wasn't a good look after you just caught a beatdown.
Yeah, but he does have the stats to back it up. LeBron just doesn't play. And one of those things where NBA players are very superstitious and mentally driven, to where you saw him take off his mask halfway through the game as if that's what was driving him down. And, you know, little things like that, like the sleeves, if he thinks that the sleeves hold him down, then they are. You know, it's a mental game.
Well, speaking of being superstitious and mentally tough, let's go to the NFL. Let's head to the gridiron, where one of Big Nasty's favorite coaches has been the topic of discussion for at least the past couple of weeks, and that is Jimmy Harbaugh, and the coach that seemingly only has one outfit that he wears everywhere he goes. See him hit that half-court shot at Michigan or Kansas?
Oh, yeah.
Wearing the khakis, and they're like, is that the only outfit that you own, coach?
He's like a cartoon.
I mean, he loves that 49ers gear, but apparently some folks within the organization aren't that fond of him. So, you know, that's been the discussion. I don't think anything is going to come from it. I think it's a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. But what's your take on the drama in Frisco, Big Nasty?
I think there's more to it than people are giving it credit for. The fact that these stories are starting to leak about Jim Harbaugh, it's obviously leaking from within the organization, and there is obviously friction there. And it doesn't surprise me one bit because of how intense Jim Harbaugh is. I mean, he is like, you know, you see Pete Carroll, and Pete Carroll's a player's coach, and he's got this energy level. Jim Harbaugh is cut from the same cloth, except instead of being like a player's coach and having that energy level, he has that intensity level. And he is constantly wearing on his players. And I think this is a 49ers roster that is so used to winning six games a year until Jim Harbaugh came along, that they are not ready for the demand and the success that Jim Harbaugh brings upon his players. He's a winning coach. He's used to winning cultures. The past 3 years, they've been a player or two from the Super Bowl. And you know, Super Bowl, let alone NFC Championship. And I just think that now his act is starting to get old in San Francisco for the wrong reason, because I think Jim Harbaugh is a great coach. But I really do think that sooner or later, this relationship will crumble.
It doesn't bother me too much because I haven't heard much from the players in terms of their despise for Harbaugh. You know, if the front office is one thing, but if Kaepernick is coming out and saying, you know, I don't know if I can play for this guy, then yeah, you might have a bigger issue at the hand. But I don't see Harbaugh in San Francisco for much longer, maybe a year or two, whenever his deal runs out. And, I mean, same deal with Stanford. I mean, he went to Stanford, did his thing, turned that program around, and eventually it was time to go. And I think eventually it'll be time to go for him in San Francisco, and he'll go on to the next job. And then the 49ers will try to figure out, you know, who the next guy is.
I do think that part of being a head coach, you know, you're sort of the CEO, the face of that organization, and part of your job is relationships. And I think Jim Harbaugh is the type of guy that is such an alpha male, is such that type A personality that I can easily see, you know, grown men, you know, that may work in college, but I can easily see grown men just kind of growing tired of that act after a while, even if it is successful. I think that, you know, you can only hear the same direction and hear the same speeches, but so many times, you know, especially coming at that volume. So I do think that there is something there, but I don't think he's going anywhere, like Marcus said, until, you know, that deal runs out.
Yeah, and I mean, there's stories out of Stanford where he, when he got angry with the team, he ended up taking every snap of practice. You know, he's just such a control freak, and this type of personality does not play in the NFL for a long term. And I just don't think Harbaugh is the type of coach to be anywhere for a long period of time because of, you know, how he acts and how he is, in that he's just going to burn himself and burn all his players out by how intense he is. And that's like the foremost reason I think that he is maybe going to be on his way out in the near future.
So do you see him signing on with another NFL team, or do you see him heading back to the college ranks?
I absolutely see him back. I think, to be honest, as much as I hate to admit it, I think USC is keeping a close eye on what's going on. And if Sark doesn't deliver the goods within the next couple of years, I think I hope we're gonna.
Are you calling for another USC coach to get fired?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I hope Sark works out. And it'd be great to have a USC homegrown coach, you know, bring us back to prominence. But I wouldn't mind having Harbaugh on a USC sideline. Absolutely.
Watch your back, Sark. As Coach O, what Big Nasty does.
I don't see that. I mean, not after the whole what's your deal, then I can't see him coming down here and coaching USC. I don't see him going back to college. I mean, the big – if he didn't leave for the Texas gig, then I'm not sure what – gig, you know, short of Saban leaving and retiring, I don't know what gig out there in college football would be big enough for him to go back into college.
He is an egomaniac, okay, and he and the best of friends, to say the least. You think that, I mean, there's something driving in the back of his mind, like, okay, Pete Carroll won a Super Bowl before I did, but if I can go here and become the greatest USC coach ever and erase Pete Carroll's legacy, maybe that could be a small driving force behind him going to USC.
No.
I think it could.
I don't think come on. No, he doesn't hate Pete that much that he wants to go back and wipe him off the earth.
I think they hate each other. I think they cannot stand each other. And this would be enough. I'm not saying it would be a motivational factor, but it would be like that last little, like in the final hour, if they're trying to get him to USC, they could just throw in, you know, Pete did win here, and maybe you could do better. That would be the thing, like, okay, I'm going to USC.
What the hell is that?
Are you fandangoing, Alfred?
That is my ringtone.
Your ring?
My phone is in the other room. I can't go get it right now. But my ringtone, my ringtone since WrestleMania of last year has been Fandango, and I haven't gotten around to changing it.
We learned a lot about you tonight.
Wow.
You guys did seriously hear that?
Yes. Yeah. Like it was in my ear. Yeah, it made the podcast. So it's...
Yeah, it totally made the podcast. But one last note from San Francisco and 49ers camp. There was a bit of a dust-up, a tempest in a teapot, if you will, on Twitter recently. with was it Lowell Cone, a writer that was kind of taking Colin Kaepernick to task, because Kaepernick allegedly wants to be paid like a top five quarterback, you know, as Alfred mentioned, taking the team to two consecutive NFC championship games. And Lowell Cone said, you know, it's like Colin Kaepernick is saying, to hell with the team, I want mine. There are words to describe his position, starting with hypocrite and ending with phony. You can fill in the words in between. And Colin Kaepernick did not respond to this gentleman on Twitter. Oh, no. Mama Kemp stepped in the ring and tweeted Lowell Cone and said, when one has the inability to articulate their thoughts intelligently, they often resort to name calling. Isn't that right, at Lowell Cone? So would you want your mama to step up for you if you were being assailed in the media, Big Nasty?
It doesn't matter whether I would want to. I know my mom would. Because just my moms, and so I love watching this. You know, my mom is very protective of me and my brothers, and so a part of me likes seeing this. But you know, Colin Kaepernick can't control his mother, especially if she has her own Twitter account and there's all this access to social media out there. So yeah, I like this a lot. I think Colin Kaepernick's mother loves him dearly. They're not blood related, but you know, that probably brings her bond together stronger, in that she was willing to take on Colin Kaepernick as a young child, as an orphan. And I like this. I love seeing stuff like this.
Between his stepmother, I guess you can call it stepmom, and his biological mother, who also made headlines a couple years ago, he's got some interesting women in his life that he has to deal with.
I mean, so what you're saying is they won't have any Chunky Soup commercials anytime soon.
No. And first off, he's not a top five quarterback. But I think the market will dictate that he's worth the $18 million a year that he's asking for, allegedly. But, you know, that's what moms do. Moms in 2014 have Twitter, and that's how they get their point across now.
Yeah, I mean, money-wise, he's going to get what the market dictates. I mean, Flacco got broke off, and you know, he's not a top five quarterback. Kaepernick should get at least Jay Cutler money. Jay Cutler money. But, you know, he's not a top five guy. I don't even know.
I don't think that matters at all, and I don't know why the top five. I mean, if he was smart, if he was a gangster, it's about the here and now. Like you just mentioned, Joe Flacco got broken off. I don't know if Joe Flacco's a top 10 quarterback. Matt Ryan got broken off. I don't think Matt Ryan's a top 10
quarterback. No, he's not.
Okay, top 10, not top five. I would say top 10, not top five. But when it comes to getting paid, it's not about being the top five or top anything at your position. It's about what have you done for me lately. You know, all Colin Kaepernick has to say is, it's a championship game. Okay, the last couple of years, I've been close to a Super Bowl. All you have to talk about is the here and now, because Joe Flacco got broken off simply because he hedged his bet and he won a Super Bowl, all right? And that's what Colin Kaepernick needs to focus on, not relative to any other quarterback, is what I think.
If anything, I think the best thing that Kaepernick has in his favor is, you know, the road ahead is wide open. You know, he's only 26. I think that, you know, the promise of the future – plus the production of the past, I think, you know, he should get broken off, and we'll see. You know, I think that he's the right guy for that team. I think he's the right, you know, he's got the right temperament to deal with a coach like Harbaugh. But I wouldn't go as far to say he, you know, he's one of the greatest quarterbacks in the game today. But he's a good fit for that team.
Jaws would.
Oh, Jaws. Jaws. So, I think that's going to do it right there. It is good to be back. We're getting back into the groove. The team is back. The band is back together. We are reunited. It feels good. And coming up next, we have a lot to talk about. We haven't done the Ringside Wrap together in a while. And boy, there's a lot to talk about, from Raw Chicago to a preview of TNA Lockdown to one of the Kings, or maybe more of the Kings, having a bone to pick with a wrestling journalist. So
we coming for you, Meltzer.
Stick and stay. War of the Kings of Sports right after this.
We three kings be stealing the gold.
This one. promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. PlaceToBeNation.com. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today. Plus, be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, PlaceToBeNation.com.
What's that?
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on PlaceToBeNation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and... Shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on PlaceToBeNation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, this sounds terrible. The Titans are wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans are wrestling off.
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for the show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pop. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling. You know you want to hear it.
And now, it's time to get you caught up on the week's biggest stories from the world of professional wrestling. It's the Ringside Wrap on the Kings of Sport.
Welcome back to the Kings of Sport radio podcast, whatever you want to call it. Marcus, Nasty, and Nate. We're talking a lot about mentors on the show tonight. And one person who I wouldn't want as my mentor, even though he's like 500 years older than me, is Dave Meltzer, who I had quite a kick.
So much for abortion into this insult here. Still straightforward.
He's not. I think it's safe to say he's not one of my favorite people.
Hashtag shots fired.
Me and Marcus were having a nice little conversation about his breaking news story this past week. For those of you who don't know, Dave Meltzer went on his podcast and said that he had a source that was 100% certain that CM Punk was going to return. And obviously that didn't happen, so Dave Meltzer became the subject of a lot of criticism on social media. I'm going to start with Marcus, because I think I've already got my shot in. We don't have to spend any more time on Dave Meltzer than we have to. But Marcus, give me your thoughts on the whole Dave Meltzer fallout, him reporting CM Punk was going to be there, and him saying that he's not too sure, even though the source was 100% certain. What do you think about this whole situation?
This really bothered me, and there's been people on both sides who said, you know, if you listen to the podcast, he clearly said he wasn't. No. He said it on the podcast because he was trying to get this reaction of this buzz, and that he was trying to get ahead of the story. And I do respect him as a journalist. I've met him a couple times. Seems like a nice guy. But you are really running a fine line when you put out a story like this, a story that you know is going to take off within the dirt sheets. And then you come back later and say, oh, I didn't say I was 100% sure, and blah, 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 blah. Like, he's one of the few actual journalists in this industry. So I really expect him to be at a higher standard when it comes to stories like this. And I really didn't, you know, I really thought he was just saying it to generate buzz to his podcast and generate buzz to the Observer. And if he was right, he was right. And if he was wrong, then he had it out. So that was my big issue with the whole CM Punk story.
Yeah, and I echo Marcus's sentiments in a sense, just by, you know, full disclosure off the top, you know, I've always respected, Dave for what he's done and what he's meant to the industry and in terms of wrestling journalism. You know, he was a wrestling journalist before that was even a thing. And you know, I give him his props for that. But, yeah, there's an element of pimping the marks that I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this story. And
well, they need to be pimped, because if they're stupid enough to fall for half the shit that comes out, then they might then go be the godfather, Dave Meltzer, to pimp these hoes. I mean, go for it.
And yeah, see, that's where, you know, I kind of, because on the one hand, I think journalistically, I think I have a problem with the way that Meltzer reported the story. But on the other hand, in terms of a businessman, you know, there's what Chris Rock said, there's no money in the cure. The money's not in the cure. The money's in the medicine. And he's pimping these cats. And if you're going to believe that CM Punk is going to show up regardless of everything that has been out there, you know, if you're going to get mad at Meltzer, you know, you should, what's the old Lance Storm line? You know, blame yourself, you know, because you allowed yourself to get wrapped up in this. So, you know, I can see both sides of the story, and I can also see how, just in terms of being a businessman, how, you know, it, I don't know, Marcus, like the businessman and the journalist, can they coexist? You know, is that something that, you know, fundamentally is a problem that, you know, in terms of a balancing act?
Well, I mean, that's one of the, I guess, conflicts you face as someone like Meltzer, who is a journalist, but he also operates and runs a business, essentially with The Observer. He's charging money for his service of podcasts and newsletters. So you have to not only, you're like sort of like Dana White. Dana White has to sell the UFC. He's a promoter. Meltzer has to promote his product. And his product includes a podcast where he dropped his CM Punk news on, I think it was a Friday or Saturday. And, you know, if he wasn't charging money for his show, would he have come out and drop this news without getting a more of a legit source behind it? Who knows? But when you're trying to make money, when you're trying to survive, then sometimes you need to give people a reason to subscribe and listen to you. And you say stuff like, oh yeah, CM Punk's gonna come back. That's what I'm hearing from a source. And you can always go back and cover it up. And because at the end of the day, we're talking about wrestling journalism. We're not exactly talking about the New York Times here. So he can be wrong. There's not enough people like us who are going to hold him accountable for what he says. So, you know, at the end of the day, he's going to come out just fine.
And that's the thing. What I didn't like, and my main criticism with this, and this might have been my criticism with Dave Meltzer, is the ambivalence in that, well, I don't know. If you're going to use the term 100% certain, you cannot in turn try to put your own type of shade on that and say, well, I don't know, but my source is 100% certain. If you don't know, you shouldn't run that story. You shouldn't say anything about it if you are not certain. Otherwise, the only thing people saw was that CM Punk, 100% certain, according to a very high-ranking source, is going to be at Raw. What Dave Meltzer thinks doesn't matter to me at that point because he runs a website, he's a journalist, and he's somebody who has sources who say things, and he's the one with access to these sources. So if you don't know, I think that kind of it hinders your brand, that you would compromise it by saying you don't know. And that's what really frustrated me, and I think Marcus hit the nail on the head by saying it's a slick, I would go as far as to say spineless, style of reporting, in that Dave Meltzer on one hand says, yeah, I've got this source, it's really sure. I mean, that's what journalists, you know, their brand is based upon their sources. And if the source is not correct and you don't think they are, you don't report that source. But for Dave to go forward with this and then at the same time says, I don't know, so that he would have an out. And that's what I've heard. People who defend Dave Meltzer have said, well, Dave Meltzer did say he didn't know. And that just drives me crazy, because if you didn't know, you shouldn't have posted the source. And it hurts his brand.
At the end of the day, does it really hurt his brand, though? Because in terms of wrestling journalism, I mean, there are some folks out there that are really, you know, digging deep and doing their due diligence. But for the most part, you know, a lot of what I see as quote unquote wrestling journalism, and I'll toss it to Big Nasty, you know, being a journalist on Bleacher Report, especially dealing with the WWE, I see a lot of people just regurgitating what they get from Meltzer or regurgitating what they get from the Torch. You know, I don't see a lot of cats actively doing anything. So when you've got, you know, two or three or four main sources that everyone else is kind of pulling from, you know, what Meltzer can, I think it's sad to say it, but, you know, Meltzer can afford to be wrong and not take a consequence. Alvarez can afford to be wrong and not take a consequence. Any of these big names, they can say what they want to say without really feeling any repercussion.
And I'll do you one better. I think it increases him. I think it makes him, his brand, better, because the reason I would ever criticize Dave Meltzer is because I hold his he's rare brand of journalism to a standard of some sort. And if it's wrong, I think people need to know about this. And I would, I mean, I think if you're giving me, I'm a columnist. I'm in the opinion business. I'm not in the news breaking business. My job is to have an opinion and make people care. Okay. And I do, and I'm not going to front, I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I do lean on people like Dave Meltzer, the PW Insider, to report things that I have opinions on. And when they're absolutely wrong, I will go out of my way to tell people that, listen, this is a guy who I've looked to when it comes to reported stories, who Bleacher Report has okayed and said, if Dave Meltzer says something, then it's right and we can run with the story. So if he's wrong, I, out of honesty, out of respect for not only my brand, but other people's brand, I'm going to say, yeah, okay, he was wrong and he needs to be held accountable. So that's really my beef with Dave Meltzer.
The wrestling, just from what I've seen from the outside looking in, the wrestling industry is one of those industries that it's hard to break news. You're not going to find like the Woj of the wrestling world because it's so controlled by essentially two companies now with WWE and TNA. And unless you have a direct source on the inside of both places, then you know you're going to be shooting darts and trying to break stuff, and you're going to be wrong a lot of the times. I think it's the reason why you don't see someone like the Masked Man out there breaking news, because there's no money to be made in trying to break news in an industry that is based on fantasy, essentially. And Meltzer has made money off of breaking news in an industry that is, you know, fantasy-based. And that means that a lot of times he will, and not just him, a lot of times these other sites will report stuff, and either we will forget to go back and see what they wrote in the first place, or it'll just be flat out wrong, and there people just move on to the next rumor that's out there. So it's interesting to just, the older I get and the deeper I get into journalism, it's kind of funny to watch how this whole profession is covered from a journalist standpoint.
Yeah, that's a great point, because if you think about traditional sports, you know, you've got the ESPNs and Fox Sports and NBC Sports and all those type of outlets. And then if you look at the entertainment world where things are purely fantasy, you know, you've got your Entertainment Tonight and your E! Networks and things of that nature. But when it comes to wrestling, which is an industry that pulls from both of those worlds, it is so controlled by Vince McMahon. It is so controlled to a lesser extent by, you know, Dixie Carter and the people at Spike TV that, you know, there is that, you know, it's interesting. Like a show like Entertainment Tonight can exist, and a show like, you know, the UFC weekly highlights show on ESPN can exist, but there's not, outside of radio shows or podcasts, there's not really a show that looks at wrestling from a journalistic standpoint.
And I don't think there should be. I mean, really, there's not that much news going on. That's just a different level of dorkiness that we need to have, like a UFC Tonight version of for the WWE. And also the UFC, for example, there. I know that Kevin Ioli on our end of Yahoo Sports breaks news, but I've noticed that, well, up until recently, that Ariel Helwani was breaking a lot of their news, but I felt like Ariel had a inside connection when it came to the UFC, and that Dana felt he was someone that he could, between their partnership with Fox Sports 1, that he could take a lot of the news that he wanted to get out there and put it out through Ariel. And I haven't seen Ariel on TV recently, and I know he just had a second kid and all that, but there was also some stuff that him and that Dana and Ariel had a falling out. So it's very tough when one man holds all the power in terms of trying to break news, because they're your source. And if your source isn't going to give you news, then where do you go?
Yeah, and we're talking about control and power. And one thing WWE was able to control was the Chicago crowd, which we heard for weeks after CM Punk left was going to be a hijacked show and WWE was going to want no part of it. I thought WWE handled it masterfully. But Marcus, we'll go right back to you. What did you think about Raw Chicago?
I thought it was a good show. My only negative was there was a lull probably halfway through the show, the Sheamus match I didn't really care for, and the Divas match. But besides that, I think the anticipation of will he or won't he come out in terms of CM Punk was great. I was invested all the way through, even to past the overrun, just to make sure that he wasn't going to like come out on the the post-game show or anything like that. And I thought what they did was great, having Paul Heyman come out to start the show, got the music. I will give Chicago fans smart. They caught on pretty quickly that it wasn't going to be Punk. That pop wasn't as loud as it should have been, and you quickly saw that they stopped cheering almost and waited for something to happen. Eventually, Heyman came out. But I think the WWE gets props for controlling the crowd. They didn't let that show get out of hand, and I think the fans eventually just wore themselves out, and that was a wrap for the night.
You know, and I think it was a masterful job by the WWE. You know, you talk about Vince McMahon and Triple H and the way that they just played that crowd like a violin. You know, they sent out Paul Heyman like you talked about, and I think that was a masterstroke because it just burned the crowd out early on. It's kind of like, you know, when your baby is fussing and crying, and, you know, sometimes you attend to it. Other times, you know, you just watch over the child and let them cry themselves to sleep, let them tire themselves out. And I think that's what they did with that Chicago crowd. And if you notice, you know, they were really, except for that opening segment and the segment with Daniel Bryan and Triple H and Stephanie, they were fairly quiet for most of the show, especially, you know, during the Divas matches or during some slow points in times that you would typically expect the audience to hijack the show. They didn't do that. And so for anybody that was thinking that this was going to be a referendum on WrestleMania, or if this was going to be some type of uprising or rebellion, you know, I think they were delusional, Big Nasty, because all signs are still pointing to Bautista and Orton at Mania.
Yeah, and you mentioned Mania, and I think that's very fitting because this is an example of how WWE can do whatever it wants. In that WWE is smarter than these fans who are going to hijack shows. People were looking at this March 3rd Raw a month in advance, right after CM Punk left. Like, this is going to be the show where fans are going to crucify WWE because CM Punk's gone. And WWE heard all that. They heard the whispers. They heard the criticisms. And they're able to adapt accordingly. And if you don't think that they have some plan in their back pocket to counter the Batista and Randy Orton main event and the acrimony from fans that's going to come out of that, then you're crazy. I mean, people want to bring up Brock Lesnar and Goldberg from WrestleMania. I think that's a complete opposite situation of what we're dealing with now, because Brock and Goldberg is a match people wanted to see. It was a dream match. But when both guys announced that they were leaving, WWE didn't want people to want to see that. So they leaked the story that these guys were leaving, and they turned the crowd against that match. This is polar opposite to where people say they don't want to see Randy Orton Batista. WWE wants you to want Randy Orton Batista. And I think WWE is going to have some trick to turn fans toward Randy Orton and Batista, whether it's Michael Cole announcing that this is going to be a social media interactive match or whatever. They have something planned, and they're going to be able to test out these hostile crowds with Washington, D.C., Memphis, and Brooklyn all coming up before WrestleMania.
You mentioned Batista and Orton. You sort of teased Brian in the midst because he was involved with both guys in that final match. So, I don't know. Part of me still thinks this match won't happen the way it's currently constructed, and Brian will somehow get his way in there. And the other thing to note is, as I was driving back to Chicago, that there's a billboard flashing that said Payback tickets on sale this weekend. June 1st, they're back in Chicago. They're back at the Rosemont Allstate Arena. Do you think that CM Punk will come back just for this show, just to sort of close up shop and say goodbye?
I think we've seen the last of CM Punk for a while. I wouldn't be surprised if this is the last we ever see of CM Punk. It would be very fitting of his character to just, you know, to just walk out, because he walks to the beat of his own drum, and he's a rebel, and this would be one hell of a way to go out for a guy like CM Punk. So I don't expect him to be back that soon.
I would think that, you know, it may be something that he would want to do personally, but I don't think, you know, there's honestly no incentive for the WWE, you know, other than one night of business. And I'm sure, you know, those tickets for Payback, you know, they're going to sell with or without Punk. And if he wasn't there this past Monday night, I don't see any reason, you know, for them to do business with him. You know, I think the big money would have been on the road to WrestleMania and the gear up to that. And, you know, I think that even though Punk is a big draw and a big deal, I don't know if he means that much to them right now, Marcus.
Well, it's not about making money. It's about, hey, CM Punk calls Vince and says, hey, look, I'm leaving, but I do want to at least explain myself to the fans as to why I left and sort of just
close the chapter. I don't know if Vince wants to give him that opportunity, though. If you know, because he's not the – we know Vince can be petty sometimes.
Yeah, but the door is open, and if Vince wanted to be petty, he would have been petty on this particular show because it would have gotten a reaction out of the crowd, and they could have done a million things. CM Punk on air, whether it be bringing out an imposter CM Punk. They could have done a million things with CM Punk, but they were very careful not to bury CM Punk. And they sympathize with his position through what they did with Paul Heyman. So I think the door is open for CM Punk to return if he were to call up Vince and say, I want to come back.
Yeah, and the best part about that whole thing is about them not being petty was, I guess, reportedly when Lesnar tossed the TV monitor into the stands, that they gave the fans CM Punk merchandise. As a result, so the fact that they're still giving out punk merchandise tells me that he's not that upset for them to completely close the door on him. So I don't know. I figured, you know, if he's going to really actually walk away, at least he should at least come back, explain himself as to what the fuck happened, and that way we can at least move on and know that he's not going to just pop up out of the blue one day, and he's going to, you know, take some time off and do whatever.
Awkward. I was going to say, that's an awkward pause.
Okay, well, speaking of awkward, if you TNA. Want to transition, yeah, there you go. I was going to go right into TNA, and what I think is a very awkward match structure in the Lethal Lockdown. I've never quite gotten it. I don't like how they do the man advantage, because I think the heel should always somehow have an advantage in a match like that. But they had what I thought was a very good episode of Lockdown. What I especially like what TNA is doing is that they're really building up Samoa Joe as a challenger, as a worthy challenger for Magnus, as somebody who's going through everybody. And now he's making Magnus tap, and there's no way that Magnus could beat him on his own. So, Nate, of course, we'll start with you. What do you think about Lockdown, which is really TNA's 1A to their number one show?
Yeah, I think that... one of the big things about this particular card is there's not the star power, quote unquote, that you had in years past, but you got a lot of young cats, you know, that are getting some opportunity to shine. You talk about Magnus, so I think is, you know, one of the better heels in the business. You talk about EC3 and his ascension, and you know, I'm really interested to see in that Lethal Lockdown match how the Wolves are spotlighted, because anybody that saw Impact this past week knows that they got a lot of shine, especially, you know, Davey Richards in particular. So I think there's some interesting things that are going to be on that card. I want to see how the Great Muta looks. I want to see how they present him in the TNA.
Great who? Because he wasn't mentioned on TV reportedly.
Yeah, they spend more time talking about Willow than the Great Muta.
That's one of the big hooks for me. Is that that's one of the things I want to see, is a Great Muta, because he was always this kind of he always had this aura growing up, because I didn't see too much of him growing up. But yeah, I have studied his career and whatnot, and I know he's one of the greats. So that's something that I'm excited to see with TNA Lockdown. It's going to keep me viewing. I really wish they would have done a better job of at least showing. I don't know how much footage they own of Great Muta, but at least doing some kind of retrospective on the Great Muta, that he's going to be at TNA Impact or he's going to be at Lockdown.
I mean, all you could really have to do is have a vignette. You know, they just did the show with Russell One. You could have had guys talking about the Great Muta, you know, whether it's, you know, Tigre Uno or some of the other guys over there just talking about, you know, Kaz Hayashi, just talking about their memories of Muta. And, you know, you can make anything look good. Just have some shots of Muta in the shadows and still photos. You can make something happen. And they did nothing with this guy. We got two vignettes for Tigre Uno, one of which was featuring an actual tiger, which was the dumbest thing ever. But nothing for the Great Muta.
Yeah,
and that's a match that I think, you know, it's you know, with the against Bad Influence and Chris Sabin. Like, that's actually for the work rate fans out there. That could be a hell of a match.
I got no interest in this card. I haven't watched.
I was
Pat
about
in
to
weeks.
Say, Marcus.
I got no interest
yeah, I was
in this fucking
say,
card.
Is there anything? Is there anything that you okay? You look at face value that you're just like, yeah, maybe I would tune in, or are you just completely tuned out on
completely
Lockdown?
Tuned out on TNA? Period.
I'm telling you, I will say Impact this past week in terms of, because you know when you grade a go home show, it's about selling the pay per view, it's about having a good show, and it's about, you know, what's the hook. And I think TNA Impact this past week did a great job of getting you, not even if you're a hardcore fan, of like if you're just watching the show, it gave you a reason to think, wow, Samoa Joe could beat Magnus. I'm going to watch this show. You know, and that's what I liked about TNA, Nate. But what do you think? What chances do you give Samoa Joe in beating Magnus?
No chance at all. But I mean, they've done a good job of building it up. Like I said on a review in Impact a couple of weeks ago, if I wasn't, you know, as quote unquote smart as I am, I could actually believe Joe had a shot the way that they've been building him up the past 2 or 3 months. But Magnus is so good, you don't want to cut that momentum off.
And, you know, pound for pound, you know, and even for coming, Magnus is that good. And some people might hear that and freak out because it's TNA and WWE and they compare the monsters. But if you look at just being a pure heel, I think Magnus is just, he's just on it. He's a natural when it comes to just being somebody who you want to pay to see get beat. And I really like the work Magnus has done. The Lethal Lockdown storyline has kind of thrown me off. I don't like that they just keep putting this percentage of ownership on the line, and I guess Bobby Roode is going to be competing for 10% ownership of company. What do you think is going to happen in that match, Nate?
This is another match where I think it's too soon. You know, they brought MVP in, and they're rushing that particular angle, and you've got all these side stories, all these side deals. Bobby Roode and Austin Aries are fighting for 10% of the company. When you split it down the middle, they only get 5%. Dixie has the other 90% of the company if they win. Like, that is ridiculous logic. So, you know, and I think they've ruined MVP. Not ruined MVP, but they've made him less special by putting him out there the past 3 weeks in the ring. They should have waited, saved him until lockdown. But, you know, I'm looking forward to the match itself. You got some good workers in there. I don't know why the bromans are in there instead of Bad Influence, but it is what it is. I do expect the heels to win, though.
Let me ask a stupid question. What is 10% of a company going to do in the storyline? Who cares about 10% of ownership of TNA? It's just...
Yeah, it looks like TNA is taking minority ownership and thinking that that is something that would be controlling, which I don't know whose job it is to research business and stocks and bonds and ownership, but I'm watching that show as a business major at the University of California at Santa Barbara thinking like
we'll get to the gauchos later, by the way.
Well, yeah, I was going to use that as a lead into our next segment, but yes, that's not how it works, folks. And, you know, now that Marcus said it, I talked about how I'm a proud graduate of the University of California at Santa Barbara, and we had an incident with a fan this past weekend, and if it wasn't that fan, it was going to be me. But we'll talk about how the University of California at Santa Barbara made the news. Olé! Second sports match.
Hulk Hogan, we're coming for you, nigga!
What's your one-stop home for your pop culture needs? Of course, PlaceToBeNation.com. We have everything you could ask for when it comes to pop culture. Now first, wrestling. We're definitely your hookup for all show recaps, including Raw, SmackDown, Impact, Ring of Honor, all of WWE's other programs as well. We have previews, live blogs, breakdowns for all WWE and UFC pay-per-views. You want sports? No problem. PlaceToBeNation has extensive articles on football, basketball, MMA, boxing, and baseball. From Andrew Reich's history lessons to the return of the hack to the Cowboys call, we have the best in comprehensive sports knowledge and opinions. With a loaded staff of hardcore pop culture writers, we also specialize in comics, TV, music, movie pieces. Of course, you can't forget Jen and Justin's journey through the 90s. You want podcasts? Well, look no further than Place to Be Nation, the home for the best catalog and variety of shows you'll find anywhere on the net. There's the Place to Be podcast, where the big boys play, the Brad and Chad show, Wrestling with the Past, Titans of Wrestling, Goodwill Wrestling, Richard and the Mailman, Grapple Talk, and the Kings of Sport with our good friend Nate Milton. Want to take a second to thank our supporters and ask you to check out their great sites. Graham Cawthon and the History of WWE.com, a complete archive of wrestling shows throughout history. Also our friend Dave at TWFnews.com, your home for wrestling news updates and great conversation. Also check out PiledriverWrestling.net for all the latest wrestling news and the home of the great Old School Wrestling Review podcast and much more. And while you're at it, if you want to chat with fellow fans about wrestling's past and present, check out Scott Keith's blog at rspwfaq.com. So for everything you need, your pop culture fix, check out placetobenation.com, the only place to be in the pop culture world.
Welcome back to the world's most dangerous sports show. Follow the danger online at facebook.com/thekingsofsport.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Welcome back to the Kings of Sport podcast, Nasty and Marcus, back by popular demand. I mean, we were just so on fire last week. We asked Nate to go home so we can just recapture some of that this week. So we're back. And I alluded to this last segment about my University of California at Santa Barbara Gauchos getting in the news. So Marcus, I'm going to throw it to you. Why don't you tell us what happened and go easy on my Gauchos, because remember, I'm a very, very proud Gaucho. So what happened with UC Santa Barbara in Hawaii?
Yeah, so I was one of the seven people actually watching this game live because as someone who went to a school in the Big West Conference like Nate did at one point, Cal State Northridge, I have an interest in Big West basketball. So I was watching a game, and UC Santa Barbara, Hawaii, two of the better teams in the conference, and there is a non-call that a Hawaii player was upset about, and eventually the referee decided to tee the guy up, and the Hawaii head coach was also upset at this point, and he had walked out to onto the court, and out of nowhere, a looked like a student, but we'll say a fan. We don't want to lump him into Alfred's people, but a UCSB fan runs out onto the court and gets in the face of the Hawaii head coach, and a couple of the Hawaii players, you know, quickly shove him and try to get him off the court, but it caught me off guard because it came so fast and out of nowhere, and the best angle, they eventually had a wide shot, and you can see him running down the stairs, just no one in his way, just a straight shot across the court, and he was able to get off the court before security even got around to him, and you know, it's scary because I've been to games in the Midwest, I've been to games at the Thunderdome at UC Santa Barbara, and there's not security really. There's certainly no metal detectors, so if he were to have something on him, I mean, there's no way for them to stop that ahead of time. So God forbid, if he did have a knife or something, he could have easily gone after the coach. So it was a scary situation that was, luckily nothing came of it. The guy was eventually arrested. And, you know, between this and we had the fan in Cleveland last week in the NBA who ran out in the court, and security eventually got him and cuffed him right there in the middle of the court. But what are the fans doing? Like, I mean, you got to... At some point, basketball's not going to be fun anymore because they're going to have to set up these barriers, sort of like hockey, where it separates the fans from the action, and that's part of the reason why basketball is a great sport to watch in person, is because there are no barriers. You are able to get that close access, and unfortunately, people are taking advantage of it.
Yeah, especially college basketball, to where there is that element of fans running onto the floor. And this is the second week in a row, Marcus, that me and you are talking about fans getting rowdy and becoming part of the story. And I have to ask whether or not people are seeing these stories make national headlines. Because remember, Utah Valley and New Mexico, these two state schools that traditionally aren't going to make headlines just for playing. Now we're getting headlines for the fans running out onto the court. So maybe people are seeing this and they're thinking, hey, maybe I can be famous. And that's going to be my reaction, is I'm going to be the next fan to run out on there and become part of the news story. And if that's the case, it's pretty scary because it's only going to get worse. And again, this is a situation that NCAA is going to have a very tough time solving, because the more they try to resist and try to protect fans from coming out onto the stands and onto the floor, the more fans are just going to rebel, and it's just going to get even uglier. So and it's so unfortunate that this is UC Santa Barbara, because you're right, Marcus, I probably, my senior year of UC Santa Barbara, I missed like probably three games, if that, of basketball when it came to home games, and there is no security whatsoever. And I would joke with my friends, like, you know what, I could run out onto that court and nobody would stop me for at least 5 minutes, you know, because there's nobody, there's probably one or two old security guards just to be there to intimidate you, but there's no security, you can do whatever you want. So it is good that a fan didn't cause any type of damage to the opposing players. And what are you doing, Santa Barbara? You got to be making headlines for things other than that, like the fact that your greatest export, Alfred Big Nasty Kunawa, is hosting a podcast. Something, not this. Ooh,
you hear that? You hear that, Josh Elliott? He said he's
Josh
better.
Josh Elliott.
Better than Josh Elliott, okay.
Better than Jim Rome. You guys bring it on, all right? I'll take you all on.
Yeah, but, you know, that guy, I mean, too much Simon Ivey before the game. I don't know what happened. I mean, did he skip Freebirds before he went in the arena?
I am impressed. You've been to Santa Barbara before.
I mentioned before I graduated from Hofstra University, I went to Cal State Northridge for a couple years. And I was on the student paper, so I covered the team, and Santa Barbara is one of those trips that I could do in one night. So I would travel up to Santa Barbara to cover the Matadors and the Gauchos, and I spent some time in Ivy. Not during the crazy times at Halloween or anything like that, but I know Woodstocks. I was there, the last time I was up there was last fall. Okay. I went for the day. Great city. Santa Barbara in general, so.
Yeah, it's a great community, and the thing is about Ivy is, like, now it's, like, I went during when it was, like, Ivy, and it just had this grunge to it and character. It's not Ivy Inc. now. It's so, they've got a bank there. They've got a couple of banks there. They've got 7-Eleven. They've got all these corporations set up. So it's really different to go back to Ivy, because I went there for alumni weekend, and I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. But it's a very beautiful town, great community. And, yeah, no, that's great to know, because I heard Freebirds, and I'm just like, man, how much does this guy know about Santa Barbara?
Woodstocks, awesome. I know a little bit, and you mentioned Jim Rome. Jim Rome is one of those people I grew up listening to, and he's always told these Ivy stories about when he went to college and just how much of a shithole it was in terms of
Sam's to go.
Yeah. Rome was there 20 plus years ago, so it's come a long way since then.
That's awesome. Well, I was talking about how I was going to take on Jim Rome and Josh Elliott. Somebody who's willing to take on a monster in their own right is Ronda Rousey, who Marcus says she can beat Floyd Mayweather. I am obliged to mention that it would be in an MMA rules type scenario, but Ronda Rousey says that she thinks she can beat Floyd Mayweather. So why don't you tell us more about this?
Yeah, I don't know if it's just a slow week MMA news or... She's not promoting a fight, so I'm not sure where this even came from. But yeah, Ronda is beating her chest that she can she would beat Floyd in a fight. They are, I would say, they're roughly the same weight, and I would actually even I think Ronda is stronger than she looks. I don't know if she's stronger than Floyd, but I mean, shit, she's stronger than me. So I think she's stronger than a lot of dudes, but. The LA Times had a poll on their website that said who would win in a fight between Rousey and Floyd. Let me see what the results are. I know earlier it was 50-50, and that's crazy, but let's just check here. 50% say Ronda Rousey, 49% say Floyd. So
I got it. I would take Floyd, okay? I mean, I don't care what... I mean, if it was MMA rules, then maybe, yes, Ronda would have a chance. But... something I wouldn't want to see, obviously, with man, woman violence or anything like that. I don't think it's something that should ever go down, even for a freak show appeal. But just as good as Floyd is pound for pound, and the fact that, I mean, you would be pitting, I don't want to claim superiority of men over women, because I think women can do everything men can do and more. I just think Floyd Mayweather's a better pure fighter. And I can't believe I'm talking about this. I don't want to sit here and break down what the matchup would be, but it would be a ridiculous scenario, and it's something that Ronda Rousey, I'll give her credit, has always been smart. She's like got that Hulk Hogan quality to her, to where she knows what to say to get herself in the news, and she knows how to work a media outlet in order to make her a front news story. And this is just another instance of that, because you're right. She doesn't have a fight coming up. Floyd Mayweather, I know they've announced the Cinco de Mayo fight, but he doesn't really have a fight that people are hot on right now. So it just really is coming out of nowhere, but it's Ronda Rousey creating press for herself, coming off a very short stretch of back-to-back fights. So, you know, I commend her at least for that standpoint. Who do you think would win?
By the way, this interview happened on Power 106, and if you're in the LA area, then that means this interview probably happened on Bid Boy's radio show. So just the fact that she's talking to Bid Boy is, you guys might know Bid Boy, the national audience, but he's just a local morning DJ out here.
Right, one of the bigger local guys.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just odd that she's... You would think she'd be doing this stuff 3 weeks ago when she had a fight to promote, not after the fact, but who would win? You know, assuming that Floyd wouldn't feel bad for popping a chick, not the first time that he's done that, I think that he would be able to get enough shots in that he would not get to the ground. If Floyd got to the mat, it'd be a wrap, because I think Ronda would just smother him. But if Floyd was able to stand on his feet, then Floyd would win. He's just too fast. If he's too fast for male boxers, male elite boxers, then he's going to be too fast for Ronda in terms of hand speed and just getting his shots in. So,
yeah, and I think that's the problem. Is that and he's a little bigger than Ronda, so he'd be quicker, and he'd be able to move around better, and that's what... Can you imagine if we saw that fight? I don't think I would sit down and watch it, just out of protest. But a fight that it was going to happen that didn't happen was Carlos Molina, who was supposed to defend his belt against Jermall Charlo, but stuff got off to him, and it looks like, stemming from a sex offending case, he was jailed ahead of the bout. Marcus, what's going on with Carlos Molina?
Yeah, so Carlos Molina, I guess he was charged of being a sex offender and in the state of Wisconsin, and he never registered as a sex offender in Wisconsin. So a warrant was issued years and years ago. He was eventually deported from the country back to Mexico. He snuck back across the border into the United States. We the people. And all this time now, it's been several years now that Carlos Molina has been fighting in the United States, and the authorities have not caught up to him. And finally, now this week in Las Vegas, he was arrested. And all this time you heard he was arrested, but people weren't really clear what he was arrested for. And there was always talk about this week about the fight happening. But eventually on Friday, they said the fight is off. Molina has bigger issues to deal with. He's currently still in jail. He's facing deportation again for coming across the border. And he's still, you know, at the end of the day, he's a sex offender. This crime, I think, went under the table. This is the first I've heard about it. And, you know, we've probably seen the last of Carlos Molina, you know, fighting in the United States.
Yeah, and I would say definitely we've seen the last of him. Just when you hear the term sex offender and how long this has been going on and how he's really been evading the authorities, I just don't think that there's any way that he can recoup from this. He's rehabilitated as a human being, but this is one of those things that you go away forever when it comes to, you know, underage sex, or there's just a few things that people just will not forgive you, and you will not be employed gainfully in American society, and this is one of them. And so I just think that he's going to have that scarlet letter forever, and we're not going to see much of Carlos Molina in a professional standpoint in boxing,
which is unfortunate because he was a champion at light middleweight. So
very good. Very, very good.
He's a talented fighter. And just, it's one less fight on this pay-per-view card on Saturday that has been pretty lackluster in terms of promotion. I'm talking about Canelo Alvarez, Alfredo Angulo, who are fighting on Saturday night in Las Vegas. And there's been no buzz really about this card on Saturday. And we had the weigh-ins on Friday where Canelo Alvarez didn't make weight. He let Nevada know ahead of time that he was going to be over, so he's been docked $100,000 from his payout. So do you have any interest in this card?
A little, because I'm still interested in Canelo Alvarez. I think I don't want to say it was a mistake for him to take the Mayweather fight, because I really did think he was ready for it, but in hindsight, I just think that he's a good enough fighter to where this shouldn't hurt him too much. And I think this is one of those fights where it's going to be a bounce back fight. He's going to put together a string of wins, and then once he grows into himself, I think he's going to be hopefully one of the all-time greats. Hopefully he's not just some overrated fighter with a lot of buzz, but he's still selling a lot of tickets, and I am looking forward to this fight, and I do think that he's going to handle this bout. I don't think it's going to be, because a lot of people are looking at this fight and they're buying it for Canelo Alvarez, and Alfredo Angulo is just like kind of a nobody, but Angulo is a very, very tricky fighter. And he's somebody I think who can, I don't want to say he can beat Canelo, but he's going to give Canelo fits, especially like later in that fight as Canelo's trying to close it out.
I think he can hurt Canelo. I don't know if he can beat him, but he excuse me, he definitely has the power to hurt him. And Canelo hasn't faced someone like Angulo with that power. So I'm curious to see what happens there. And if you don't know the backstory with Alfredo Angulo, you should look up, I'm sure there's probably several videos on YouTube about the drama he went through, but he essentially was detained at an immigration detention center for 7 months. He was literally just trapped there, and it all had to do with a expired work visa. Mm-hmm. And it derailed his career to the point where, I mean, people really didn't know where the hell he was. And eventually came out that he was in California at this detention center, and he spent a good part of more than half a year there. He's come back. He did lose in his last fight to Yerson De Lara, the Cuban fighter. But
yeah, that was out in Carson, like just down the street from me.
It was, yeah. But he's a talented fighter. He's sort of a one-dimensional fighter. But and I'm curious to see what happens with this fight. I don't want to say it's a must-win fight for Canelo, but if he has back-to-back losses, then he's going to have a long road ahead of him in terms of what his next step is. And maybe it's in a different weight division, because if he can't make 154, then maybe he needs to look into moving up to 160.
And I think he should already be looking into that, because he walks around, just he's a big boy.
Yeah.
And it is a constant struggle for him to keep this type of weight. So I really think he already should be looking into that. And, you know, I think it is a must-win fight, not to put too much pressure on it, but I think the way people are going to perceive this, and the casual fans who are so important to boxing, if Canelo loses this fight, they're going to perceive it as him losing to a quote-unquote nobody, or losing to somebody who isn't Floyd Mayweather, and they're going to think that he's an absolute fraud, because he was exposed to a standpoint against Floyd Mayweather. But yeah, if he doesn't win this fight, he's going to be in big trouble as far as a money fighter moving forward. So I do think he needs to win this fight.
And with Daniel Canelo, he was basically getting hand-picked, hand-fed opponents up until Austin Trout last year, last April, and he defeated Austin Trout. And I think that's
what people thought.
Yeah, it went 12 rounds, and, you know, he didn't look great, but he looked good enough. But before that, you know, Josecito Lopez, who he might as well be out the sport at this point, the way his career is going. You know, Shane Mosley washed up, Kermit Cintron washed up. So he was getting cupcakes and building on this impressive undefeated streak, and eventually ran into Floyd Mayweather. And as Floyd has done, he defeated him. So he needs to really come back and defeat Angulo, and, you know, hopefully he can set up some type of a bigger fight in September. I'm not sure if he wants to stay 154 or move up to 160. If he stayed at this weight, I'm not sure who he could really compete against at 154.
Yeah, that's it. I mean,
well, the problem is also that Floyd owns those belts
exactly
at 154. And Floyd's also the guy who doesn't really care about the title, so eventually he will have to vacate those titles when he decides to fight at 147 primarily. So he's in a tough spot, because you got Floyd has two belts and Molina has a belt. So three of your titles are held up for the time being and will eventually be stripped from all three, I'm assuming. So he's in a weird spot for the time being.
Yeah, and I just anticipate this being an entertaining fight. I think we're going to have a couple of flurries where they just go and stand and trade. And I really do think that this is going to be a better fight than people are looking at this as one-sided fight. I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Actually, what about Cotto?
Yeah, no, Cotto's always fun to watch. He's always overachieves when it comes to his fights. Even Floyd, those last few rounds against Floyd, he had him.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be a great spectacle, but if people wanted to see what your take was, and you were tweeting live, Marcus, and watching this fight, where would they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Marco Will, MarcoWill.
And of course, as always, you can find me at This Is Nasty. Watch my articles on Bleach Report and the videos if you so choose.
I highly recommend the one from this week. It was brilliant.
Thank you very much. I did go after Meltzer a little bit. And yeah, so go ahead. I did a little Tinder spoof too. But Marcus is here and Nate is gone. So I guess I'm going to take over for Nate's little role. And I'm going to try out his little catchphrase. So for Marcus Vanderberg, for the godfather Nate Milton, I'm Alfred Big Nasty Kunwa, and you've been down with the Kings. He gone!
Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Kings of Sport. Be sure to come back next week for an all-new episode. You can leave feedback for the show on Twitter at KOS_POD or via Gmail at thekingsofsport@gmail.com. Don't forget to like and rate us on iTunes and tell a friend. The Kings of Sport is a production of the Mosaic Podcast Network.
Whether you like it or not, he's back. D-A-double-D-Y, that's X. Sharp as a tack, like I just left.